I brought some notes so you'll feel better. I'm not going to use them very much. And I brought a clock. Yoli told me I got to stop pretty soon. My name is Willard Machen, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's by the grace of God and the help of this program and a lot of people like you and a lot of people in this room that I've been sober every day since September 13, 1965, one day at a time. If you can do that, I recommend it. It's pretty good. It's in 72 days, I'll have 50 years. And I want to... In San Antonio, I got in the old-timer section, and somebody saw me, and they raised the limit, so I couldn't get in anymore. And I'm sure in Detroit, it'd be 55 years, so, but that's all right. Anyhow, this is this session is about the Southwest region, meet your neighbors. And I've been in the Southwest region for a long time. You can tell I've been somewhere for a long time, just looking at me. And so we are the neighbors, okay? So I want to tell you a little bit about my journey in sobriety. And my sobriety was in the Southwest region. And I'm going to tell you about how I was introduced to service and what it meant to me. And I'm going to tell you about me, which is I really like to do that. Because I like me a lot. I like me good. When I came to my first meeting, I was 24 years old, and my sponsor asked me, how long can you go without taking a drink? And I said, sometimes I go 2 or 3 days. If it's not over a weekend, I couldn't make a weekend. But he said, kid, you got this program made. You don't ever have to go 2 or 3 days. He said, you believe you go one day and not take one drink? And I said, I believe I can do that. And we started this journey on that simple premise. Go one day, not take one drink. And every morning I read Dr. Bob's last message. And he says, let's keep this thing simple. You know, it's really simple. My program is so simple that some of you really complicated people couldn't do it. Because the formula he gave me was, number one, he said, get out on your knees in the morning and ask God to help you stay sober. And number two, don't drink any alcohol. Really important. If you're having trouble with this program, look at that middle step about drinking that alcohol. That's probably where your problem is. And then he said, get on your knees at night and pray to God. And thank him for keeping you sober. And I try to do that every day. And I was there just a short while. I got in September. In November, he come by and said, you need to give me $3.65. And I said, how come? He said, we're going to send it to New York. And I said, what for? And he said, it's for gratitude for your sobriety. And they recommend you give a penny a day for your sobriety. It's worth that. He said, give me the money. And we pretty well based my giving in Alcoholics Anonymous based on how I gave when I was at the bar. And he said, if you got money for whiskey, you got money to put a dollar in the hat. My sponsor told me, don't come to this meeting without a dollar. Now, that would hurt some people's feelings today, I know, if you would be highly offended that you got to have money to come in AA. He said, you got money for whiskey, you got money for AA. So he told me to bring my money. And so I learned about Gratitude Month. I learned about New York. And in about 3 months, he made me buy a copy of AA Comes of Age. And I learned about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. And at that current time, he was an alternate delegate, and he told me about all this stuff. And I was thinking the other day, I read a number, and I sure wouldn't want to offend anybody by what I'm about to say. I don't care. There are all these areas have structure manuals. We got this structure. And by the structure of any manual, Northwest Texas, Southwest Texas, I wouldn't have been nothing. Because the way I got to be GSR the first time, that old man said, you're going to be GSR. And I had 9 months sober. But now you got to have a year. You got to have, I don't know what the rules are. But he said, I said, okay. And we did it. So that was my service as GSR. I thought I did pretty good. And when I got to be DCM, I lived in Arizona. And they had an inactive DCM. He'd been DCM for about 7 years. Nobody ever seen him. So I called him on the phone one day and I said, how would you like not to be the DCM anymore? He said, I would love it. I don't know how to get them to stop sending me this stuff. And I said, I'm going to help you. I'll be the DCM for a while. So that was my service as DCM. I didn't serve a full term. I didn't get elected. I didn't get nothing. And I was a pretty good DCM, I think, because I stayed sober and I went to meetings and I went to service meetings. And in Arizona, was in the Pacific region. I went to the Pacific region service meetings and watched them elect delegates and trustees, and I did all that stuff. And when I got to be the delegate, matter of fact, I was at AA about 2 weeks. See how much time I got. I don't want to get carried away. Oh, I just got started. It's going to go a long time. When I was at AA about 2 weeks, a guy showed up at our meeting who was the delegate. I knew who the delegate was. It's Joe Clary. Everybody know Joe Clary. And Joe's gone, but a lot of people here know Joe. And every time you go to a conference, every time you go to a convention, Joe Clary sat right there. And his secretary was Francis, and Francis sat right there. They were the first ones there. They was on the front row. There's a front seat. And Joe Clary went to the General Service Conference, and he was on the Grapevine Committee. And he came home and he sold grapevines for 25 years till he died. Every convention you went to in West Texas, in this area, every conference you went to, the chairman always said, we got a magazine salesman wants to come up here. And Joe Clary got behind the microphone and sold grapevines every time. He never stopped serving the grapevine. Never. This is my example I had for this. And so I learned about all this stuff. I learned about the delegate. And after my first sponsor passed on, my second sponsor was a delegate in panel 72. Panel 70. Tom O'Neill was panel 70. So I always had a delegate, or an alternate delegate as a sponsor. And service sponsors are good. They help you learn about what goes on in your area and what you need to do. But I had this old man to me, my sponsor, was my service sponsor. He was my financial sponsor. He told me to get a job and go to work and keep working and pay your bills. And he was kind of a marriage counselor type sponsor. And he said, you leave her alone. And that was his advice for my marriage. And in 22 days, we'll be married 55 years. And now, that's the testimony of Alcoholics Anonymous and what this program can do in your life, the power of this program in a person's life. This sobriety I talked about, that's a testimony and should be a testimony to new people. I heard these old pioneers talking a while ago, and they're 60 or 70 years sober telling about the old people that helped them. That's why I'm here, because these people were there and helped me and took me and showed me about this. And they started me going to service assemblies. In West Texas, we had one standalone assembly a year, maybe. When I first came in, we had one every other year, and that was to elect a delegate. All the area assemblies were business meetings, and they were held during conventions and conferences. At the Midland Conference, we'd have a block of time, about 1 to 4 hours. 1 to 4, we'd have a business meeting. That was the area assembly. And at the Top of Texas Roundup, we'd have one. At the Lubbock County, everywhere we went, when it was close to the four quarters, we would have a service assembly mixed in with a convention. And the idea was you could come to this convention, you could bring your family, you could experience an AA weekend, you could get all this spiritual growth, and then you could do your service too. Then during the election year, we'd have a standalone assembly and have a delegate come out. When I got elected delegate, they asked me, said, we ought to put your name in for, would you be alternate delegate? I said, I guess I could. You're not going to get many votes because we're in the panhandle of Texas up in Amarillo, and all the power was down around Odessa Midland. You know how power moves. It's got. And we had a lady running for delegate. She was pretty much going to be delegate. That was, we just knew. We knew who the delegate was going to be. There was no doubt. So when we got there, this old man said, well, instead of alternate delegate, how about I just nominate you for delegate? Let's get this over with. And I said, do what you got to do. And I almost got elected on the first ballot, and I couldn't believe it. I was shocked. She was shocked. I don't know which one of us was shocked the most. But the lesson in this is this. Here's what happened. This is a wonderful lady, and I loved her, and I still love her. And she was running for delegate, and her face turned pale on this dais up here. And she got up and went and composed herself and come back and was a lady, and she accepted. She later on got to be delegate when it was her time to be delegate. I read periodically in this story out of the big book about Earl Treat in Chicago who couldn't get AA going, and he go to Dr. Bob and say, why won't they come to AA? And Dr. Bob said this, when you are right and the time is right, providence will provide. You could live your life on that principle. When I'm right and time is right, these things which are supposed to happen to me are going to come about. Or as old Cecil used to say, our friend said, my will and God's will usually run about 18 months apart. That's about how it runs. I kind of get ready for this stuff, and it runs. And I started, but these are the kind of people I had. And I rode home from that being elected to delegate with two delegates in the front seat. And they were arguing about something. They fought and argued all the time. My sponsor was an old man that got sober in Huntsville. And he did not like to take no for an answer. And he told you what you need to do. And I always used to have a favorite saying when we'd eat something. I'd say, man, I eat like a convict. One day he told me, he said, what do you know about how a convict eats? I said, well, I don't know. I ain't even been in jail. I don't know. Now. He said, why don't you stop saying that? I said, oh, okay, I guess I will. I won't say that anymore. And but this old man took me in a meeting one night, and he said, I was sitting here where Ray is and another guy, and I was there by him. I told him stuff going on. He said, get around, get on your knees. I said, what? He said, get on your knees. And I said, people are right over there. We don't. And he made me say the third step prayer right in front of this people. And I learned to do that. It was a turning point in my life. And there's been many, many turning points in my life. These little things which saved my life. And the only thing from my notes I've said so far is I remember Bill said when he was in Texas in 1954, in one of his talks, he said, on such slender thread, our destiny hangs. And that's my experience. On such slender thread, come to one meeting, see one person, read one sentence in a book, go to one different meeting you hadn't been going to. Who knows what to see? So that's what we got to learn, how that our destiny is going to come about when the time is right and when we're right. And then providence is going to provide what we need. When I went to the delegate panel 34, which is 1984-85, Lois was still there. I made my first international convention in 1975. And we're sitting here, we're sitting here at a little meeting getting ready for the big meeting. If you get that big meeting picture of 1975, you see the back of my head, about on the third row right down there. I can still see it. I had a lot of hair then. But I get up and go walk around the corner, and there says Lois in his chair. So I go over and see Lois. She's real fragile. I said, how you doing? I went and come back and told these guys, come here, guess who I found? You know, I found Lois. And we go back, and she's already surrounded pretty much. And then we went to Stepping Stones. And Lois still lived there. And they all the delegates went, and they drug out a little couch. Lois sat on a couch in the living room, and you got to sit down there next to Lois, and she'd talk to you. She's about 89 or 90 years old then. You tell her you're from Texas. She said, you know so-and-so in Dallas. I know somebody in Lubbock. She knew people all over the country. And that changed my life. Changed my life. And so I was a delegate a couple of years. Matter of fact, I love New York so much. I came home, and my wife and I decided we're going to go to New York. And so I was a division chairman at a community college, and I was a business. I taught economics and business. I resigned my chairman's job. She quit the phone company job she had, and took us about 2 years to get all that together. Sold all my cars. Day before I left New York, I had no cars. Living in a rent house. Don Deckard loaned me a car. A guy I sponsored loaned me a car. So you guys be careful. You may have to take over again. And I went to New York, stayed 4 months. Changed my life. I went to GSO, sat in archives all day. Frank Mauser was an archivist. And I'd go in, and Nancy would stay home. I'd go in and go to GSO and read in archives all day long until Frank got off work. And then we'd go to meetings. I'd stay all night at Frank's house, and then we'd go jog around Central Park. We'd go right. Changed my life. You got to go have these experiences. You know, if you want to do this stuff, you got to go do it. I hope Ed's in the room. A guy we was talking to said he'd like to move to Albuquerque, and I said, move. Go home, sell your stuff. Get out. You know, this ain't no dress rehearsal. If you want to see this stuff, you got to go do it. You know, these guys I run with, you know, they'll say, let's go to New York. And we'll say, okay. And next thing you know, eight of us are stepping stones somewhere. We go do this stuff. We went to, did my watch quit? No, it's still going. I'm good. You pull my tail out, motherfucker. Okay. We went to New York, went to Stepping Stones, the Bedford Hills, and then we went up to the, where'd Bill live? Yeah, went to Wilson House, went to Grave, went out to Bill Grave. And I had just got the day before, I got a chip. I went to GSO and they gave me a chip. Or John had me a chip for 48 years. So when you go up there, it's kind of customary, you put your chip on Bill's grave, you know. So I got up there, had a 48-year chip I just got. So laid on Bill's tombstone, which I thought was pretty spiritual. And one of the goobers I sponsored back here was fixing to have 22 years sober. So I looked, and there's a 22-year chip. So I took that 22-year chip and put it in my pocket. And so birthday night, I gave him a 22-year chip. And he said, you took a chip off Bill's grave? So I said, yeah, he still owes me 26 years, best I can figure, you know. I left a big one. I took a little one. I mean, I thought that'd be fair, and I bet Bill had thought that was pretty good. That's what I think. We went to Dr. Bob's house. We did all that stuff. Because people got me involved in AA. If you want to be involved in AA, you got to go do it. You know, they had no newcomers going to come by in front of your recliner when you're sitting at home watching TV. You got to get out. You got to go where they are. There's no history going to come to you when you're sitting at your home. You got to go find out where history is. The other night in my group, we read the part about where Abby sat across that table from Bill and told him, me and half a dozen guys in this room sat around that table, said the third step prayer, that table, that very table. I mean, we went up to Dr. Bob's house, got out on our knees at the end of that bed, said the third step prayer. Cried like a baby. I wasn't the first one that cried, though, I'll tell you that, okay? I cried a little, but I wasn't first. Okay, that's all I want you to know that. I'm like, oh, man, don't cry like that. I don't do that. But I tell you, this has been a marvelous experience. My journey has been wonderful. I've had some ups and downs. Everybody has ups and downs. My sponsor told me, he said, say that little prayer every morning, and I say, God help me this day not to take a drink. Show me what you want me to do and give me strength to do it. May I do thy will always. And one day I said that and I got a degree in graduate school. One day I said that my little grandson was born. One day I said that my mother died. The same day. Today's the day. This is our day. We have no other. Got to remember that. Today's the day we don't drink. And we do it by using these principles of this program. This program is permanent. People are temporary. The group I came in is gone. My sponsors are gone. The book is still here. The principles of this program are still here. They are infinite. And this is so powerful if we just knew it. If we knew the power of this program and the power that's in that book, it'd blow the roof off this building. I thank you for being here. I love you. I came here with no friends, and I can't believe these people in this room that I see that I love, and I can't tell you how much I love you. Thank you. I didn't get to my notes.
The next speaker, I met him at one of the Sarazes. And we used to we would get together. The chairman, the area chairmen, would get together for breakfast, or I forgot what it was, but we'd get together. And this person came in as a chairman when I was leaving as a chairman. And the following, and as I finished, as I was going through my term as a delegate, he was going to, and he says, "I seem to be following you, Yoli." And I said, "Yes, that's true." He is from Area 46, New Mexico. Please bring in Ray.
Hi, everybody. My name is Ray, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm really glad to be here with you today. My home group is the Cosmopolitan Group in Albuquerque, New Mexico. My sobriety date is August the 28th, 1987. I want to start off by thanking Willard and all of you for being here today. You know, this is really about us. I think that one of the greatest things about being at a international convention is that it's a celebration of unity. You know, whoever happens to be standing up here talking, it doesn't really make that much difference. It's more about all the people that are here in the room, all the people that are not drinking today. So Southwest U.S., meet your neighbors. I found out a little bit about AA in New Mexico, to kind of throw into this talk, which is that AA started in New Mexico right after the Second World War in the mid-1940s, and we had groups in Carlsbad, Santa Fe, and Albuquerque that all started right about the same time. Now there's about 400 registered AA groups in New Mexico. Normally when I give my talk, I talk about the steps and how I was able to recover from alcoholism. And, you know, today, that's important. That's a really important part of it. But today I'm going to talk a little bit more about the service part and the unity part. So I had my first drink when I was about 4 or 5. That was about 1958, 59. In the mid-60s, I was a teenager. I started getting my own alcohol and loving it. It fixed me. It was my solution. It was the love of my life. It answered all my problems. And by the time I was 20 years old, by the early 70s, I was drinking daily. I was a daily drinker. And I didn't think of myself as an alcoholic back then. I thought of myself as a hard drinker. I was a hard drinker. That's the way I looked at it. I'd get on an airplane. In those days, the stewardess or the attendant would come by, and I would say, "Every time you come by, I'd like you to drop off a drink for me, you know? Just every time you have to make the trip, just drop off a drink." And I was throwing them down as fast as she could walk by, you know? Tried not to get behind, and I would, you know, I started getting arrested, I started getting DWIs, I started having blackouts, and my solution became my problem, and I didn't know how I was going to live without alcohol. But I was scared of going to the state penitentiary, which is where I was headed. I just needed one more DWI, which I was bound to get. I drank every day and drove every day. I calculated I could have had over 5,000 DWIs. You know, I look around the room and there's one guy in this room that drank with me back in those days. He knows exactly what kind of alcoholic I am. I don't care about people. I don't care about anything. I care about drinking, getting messed up, and that's where I come from. I had my last drink on August the 28th, like I told you. About a month later, I met a guy that I used to drink with that was not drinking, and he took me to my first meeting, which was my home group, the Cosmopolitan Group. I met people there that changed my life. I like what Willard said about that, hanging from a thread. You know, I met an older lady there who changed my life that night. She talked about drinking the way I drank. And I didn't have anything in common with her. We didn't look alike. We didn't come from the same background. But she talked about alcohol the way I felt about alcohol. And she wasn't drinking. You know, I met a little guy who shook the book at me and told me, if you don't take these steps, you're going to drink again. And I was so afraid of drinking again. I mean, fear has been my, doing the fear inventory, I have no lack of fears. You know, even today, I'm afraid of so many things. And it just reminds me I need God's help. It just reminds me that I need to breathe and I need God's help. So I joined this group called Cosmopolitan Group. I found my first sponsor there. And when I was about a year and a half sober, they asked me if I'd be the alternate GSR. And I said yes. I had been through the steps once. I was on my second trip through the steps and my life was getting better and they had given me the key to the place and I had a bunch of duties and I figured I just did what they told me, And I started going to these district meetings and these district meetings were like bigger, different groups. And I got a chance to hear about their problems and it was kind of like a different home group. I got to tell you, I love my home group. They took me in. I was a bad alcoholic and they gave me the answers. They showed me how to put my life back together. So I was loyal to these guys. And, I'm loyal to my home group now. I kind of got off kind of quick. I should probably thank my wife who's here today because she puts up with a lot of the insanity that I still have, I'm still crazy. I'm not drinking today, but I'm capable of so many crazy things. And, I need God's help every single day to make it through the day. Stay away from that first drink, but, to begin to integrate these steps and these principles in my life, I need God's help for that. Because I'm not, that doesn't come natural to me. So the district meetings were cool. I started going to these area assemblies, and they were like 150 people in a room, kind of like this. And they were from all over New Mexico, different home groups, and they were coming together and talking about going into jails and treatment facilities and all this kind of stuff. And, they were all seemed pretty happy. It was like a bigger home group. I had my Cosmopolitan home group. I had the district, which was a little bigger home group. I had this area and I was meeting these people and I started to really like them, I got a service sponsor who was a panel 26 delegate, past delegate. His name was Larry Kay. And Larry would drive me around to all these assemblies. And I liked that because I didn't have to use my truck or my car or my gas. We went in his car. He paid. He was really generous. He was so generous with his time and with me. And he guided me. And I didn't know what he was doing, but he was growing me, 1992, I became the alternate DCM. I had finished my 2 years as a GSR, and they needed an alternate DCM. I said, yeah. I said, alternate doesn't really have to do that much. You just sort of sit there, And so I did that for a couple of years. In 1994, I became the DCM, the district committee member for District 11 in Area 46. And that was 1994. In 1995, they had this international convention in San Diego. And my service sponsor said, let's go. And I drove out there and I went to San Diego and I was sitting in this meeting, which is Southwest U.S. Get to Know Your Neighbors. And there was the guy at the podium was a guy by the name of David Aronofsky from Texas. And this dude, man, he was a little guy, but he was powerful. And he was talking to us, and he was talking about the need for leaders in AA. Make no mistake about it, AA needs leaders, but they rotate. So we always need leaders. Now, there is not a shortage of good leadership in AA. There is tons of good leaders out there, you know. And that's what I heard in his message, is that we need to, we're constantly looking for new people to guide Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think the most important part of this is the traditions, and second tradition which says that our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. That's the key thing. Leaders are servants. They don't wear anything. You know, the highest you can get in Alcoholics Anonymous is sober, you know. That's the highest you can get. But this path of service, general service, you know, this lady explained it to me one time, and she said, it's like going to a banquet. It's like going to the buffet. And you can go to your one meeting a week and take your happy meal and go sit down and go eat it, you know. Or you can go do the stuff and you can get the baked Alaska and the prime rib and the lobster and all the other good stuff. You can take it all the way down and enjoy the whole thing. And this lady was so cool. Her name was Jo R. She used to say this other thing that I really love. You know, you go to all these meetings in Alcoholics Anonymous and the topic is gratitude, you know. Yeah, we're all grateful. We're grateful. We're grateful. She says, if you're grateful, tell your feet. And I'm like, what? She says, if you're grateful, tell your feet. Get busy. Go get out there. Go do stuff. You know, carry the message. When somebody asks you, can you do this? You say yes, if you can. You know, you don't say, oh, I might have an appointment that night, or I might have something going. We get these great lives. We get these great girlfriends and wives and jobs and extracurricular activities. But I'm a bad alcoholic, man. That's what I am. And without this program, that's exactly where I'd be. So, you know, that's really important. Wilbur, do me a favor. Hand me that water, would you, please? Thank you, brother. So, the other cool thing about that 1995 convention, we were riding in these school buses. And I was in a school bus from downtown to the, they called it Qualcomm Stadium or something. And I was riding with these two people from Venezuela. They were sitting behind me, this man and this woman. Man, they were dressed to the nines. They were all looking good and going to the big meeting, the Friday night meeting, tonight's meeting. And they started talking to me about their home group in Venezuela. And it sounded just like my home group, you know. It sounded just like my home group. It just struck me, and so I started attending these service assemblies like these guys have talked about. We have them in the Southwest region. We have them every 2 years. We have SWARSA every 2 years, and every other 2 years we have this thing called the Southwest Regional Forum. That's when guys from New York come out to the Southwest and answer questions, and we can talk to them. And by the way, Chris told me to say that we're going to be having one of those in October in St. Louis. That's a paid political announcement, but that was really not paid, no. But anyway, that they're having that. He'll have some flyers by the door for you. But, you know, these are regional events where people from all the areas that make up the Southwest region, Arkansas, Missouri, Oklahoma, Colorado, Texas, New Mexico. I think I'm probably leaving somebody out, Oklahoma. I don't know if I said that. Kansas, there you go. So they all come together, and it's the bigger family. It's the bigger family, you know. We come to the international, it's the biggest family. It's the biggest. It's all the countries. It's all the flags we're going to get to see tonight. They're all just like us. Man, that was so cool. And so in 1996, I served my area as the alternate chairman. In 1998, I got chosen as the chairman. And I was doing all this regional stuff. And then in the year 2000, I was chosen as the alternate delegate. But our delegate, now in the Southwest region, what we have, this is really important. Southwest region, every year we have this thing called the Southwest Regional Delegates Assembly. And that's an assembly that's held in Oklahoma City, and we prepare the delegates who are going to the conference. And in the year 2000, I went to that as the alternate delegate. Now, the delegate from New Mexico couldn't attend that year. So all these old guys are saying, are you going to the conference? Are you going to the conference? Is David going to be able to go? And I said, I think he's going. But they didn't take my word for it. They prepared me to go. And they were like, really, I mean, this guy, Conley, Twisted, he talked to me and got me ready. And there was this other old guy by the name of Mike Rainbolt, and I can use his last name because he's deceased, but he's from Oklahoma. And Mike came up to me, and Mike said, do you know Larry Kay? And I said, yeah, he's my service sponsor. And he goes, yeah, he's my friend. He goes, listen, if you need anything, ask me. I'll help you. And I'm like, I'm looking at all these old guys, and they all go to Oklahoma on their own dime, and nobody pays them to go there. They all go there to help get the delegates ready. And they love Alcoholics Anonymous so much. I mean, they didn't know me from anybody, and they were treating me really good. And it's not because they liked me. It's because they loved Alcoholics Anonymous, and they wanted to make sure I didn't screw it up, you know? Which I couldn't, of course, but, you know, just it was just so beautiful to see this. What I saw were the guardians of AA tradition, you know? The thing I love about the International is that it is tradition one. It is unity, you know? And Gary Kay, who's a great guy who's helped me a lot from Colorado, has talked about, we've got these traditions of unity and anonymity. They're like the bookends. And everything in the middle is kind of connected, you know? All the other traditions are kind of connected. We need these traditions to keep Alcoholics Anonymous alive. And that's my job, you know? I've worked the steps a bunch of times, still working them. You know, I have a great life now. My life has been put back together in a different way. I'm a different person than I was. But my job now is to, through the traditions, make sure that AA is still around for the kids that are being born today who are going to be alcoholics. So Mike was great. So I need to talk about one other guy, who is a guy by the name of Jimmy D. He was my sponsor. So I had my first sponsor. I had my second sponsor. My third sponsor is actually also in the room today. This guy gave me so much. You know, I mean, sponsorship is so important. It's the way that we, you know, I was thinking about AA this week. And what I think AA is AA is the place where we come to say, I need help. And it's also the place where we get to offer to be helpful. You know, we get two things. We get to ask for help and we get to give help. And that's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. We ask for help and we give help. And, so Jimmy D was a panel 20 delegate, which is to say he served in 1970 and 1971, 2 years. 1970 was Bill Wilson's last conference. So Jimmy was at the conference with Bill. Great time. In 1971, Bill died. And he went to the conference and there was no Bill. It was everybody's first time with, you know, first conference without Bill. And, you know, after Bill threw these traditions at us to help us keep AA healthy and alive, he came up with these concepts. And the concepts are the guiding principles for the conference. You know, I've talked a lot about the conference. The conference is a really beautiful thing. I got a chance to go there in 2002 and 2003 and serve on the conference. That's another family. There's 90-some areas. There's trustees. There's staff members. About another 150 people in that room who love Alcoholics Anonymous. But they're different people every year. You know, every year half of them leave and another half come in. It's just a miracle. It's just an absolute miracle. It's like my wife and I got in on the airport. We got on that MARTA train and we were in there and people were like talking to us. I met this guy from Ireland. We're all like having this great time. And AA is like the biggest losers club in the world, where we come together and we repair each other's lives and we make each other whole and we change each other. And God's really doing it. You know, he's just using us. It is so great, you know. And so what Bill had done is he had written these concepts for the conference. Now, the conference has been operating without Bill since 1971. And, you know, I think Alcoholics Anonymous is doing really good. You know, there's ways it can be we can improve, you know. I think we really need to, you know, figure out this whole self-supporting issue. You know, we have a seventh tradition that says we're self-supporting through our own contributions. But make no mistake about it, we are not. You know, without those book sales, things at the General Service Office would have to look a lot different. And I think something's got to change. We've either got to reduce the amount of service that we're providing the groups at that office, or we've got to increase contributions. And, you know, that's one of the areas that I think that we need to continue to grow in. So my role now is I try my best to go to these area assemblies and learn how to be an elder statesman. It's really hard. Learning how to be quiet and wait is really hard because I just want to speak so much. You know, I do better when I just keep my mouth shut. In fact, I came up, well, sometimes less is more, you know, in terms of speaking. And especially as an elder statesman, it's better just to wait. I remember when I got chosen as the delegate, though. This is the ego talking, and it's kind of messed up, but I'm going to go ahead and say it. When I got chosen as the delegate in 2002, my heart went like this. Woo-hoo! Woo-hoo! And it wasn't so much that I would get to serve as a delegate for 2 years and come to New York and be a part of the General Service Conference, because I didn't even know what that was. The best part of it was that I was going to get to go back to SWRDA and help new delegates for the rest of my life. And, you know, so home groups, and that includes this home group, growing new leaders and keeping AA healthy for the young alcoholics that are being born today. I think that's what our job is. So thank you all for listening, and I wish you another 24 hours tonight.
Before I introduce the next speaker, I want to tell you what happened 2 weeks before this convention. I got a call from Ray. He says, "Exactly what are we supposed to talk about?" And I'm like, "Well, if you don't know, I don't know." So that was my reaction. And I said, "Oh my God, this is just a few weeks ago, about 2 weeks away, and I don't know what they're supposed to talk about." And I felt, you know, like, "Oh my God, as a regional trustee, I'm already not doing a good job." But anyway, so I got everybody on email and asked everybody, you know, what they knew, and they all told me, they all wrote back, and I wrote and I told them what my experience was when I did this in Minneapolis, what happened since, and I was supposed to get a hold of Eva, which I did. I think she was real busy, so she didn't return my call. And so I says, "Well, that's what we're going to do, you know, what my experience is." And then Eva finally calls a week ago. She calls and she tells me, "Oh, that's fine. She says, "But I really would have liked this." I'm like, "Oh, really? You call me now to tell me this?" So I'm sitting there thinking, and he says, "And normally the old timer does it." I said, "Oh, I'm going to tell Willard to change his topic now? The old timer, I'm supposed to do that? No way." So, and then I thought, "Well, and Ray, well, we were, like I said, we grew up together. He's going to look at me and say, 'Well, I was the one that called you, and now you're telling me.'" So I says, "I'll just call the youngest of the group. They always like to do things anyway." And by her email, it looks like she's got things going anyway. So I did call the youngest of the group, and she said, "Oh, I'll be so happy. I'm glad I'll do it. Thank you very much." And I'm sitting there thinking, oh my goodness, because I would never accepted it that fast, that quick, and that grateful. I wouldn't. But she did. She made me feel very, very proud, very happy. Well, I'll introduce you to Melissa Redd.
Thank you, Yolanda. Hi, everyone. My name is Melissa Redd, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 15th of 2001, and my home group is the Humble Group in, the Good News Group in Humble, Texas. I'm glad Yolanda told that story. I did really have a great time researching our seven states, and actually it gave me some insight to some of my fellow delegates and past delegates in the Southwest region. And so I'm not going to name any names, but just listen closely and you'll see what I mean here. Okay, so how AA came to the Southwest region. AA started in Kansas City with Johnny P., a Skid Row drunk who had tried to kill himself three times before getting sober in the Chicago group Alcoholics Anonymous. At 9 months of sobriety, Johnny landed a new job as a candy salesman and was being transferred to Kansas City, Missouri. Concerned about maintaining his new way of life, he wrote the New York office for information about Alcoholics Anonymous in Kansas City, and he received three letters back. And these letters were written in response to the article in the Saturday Evening Post. One was from a doctor, one from a druggist, and one from a CPA. So in early April of 1941, Johnny P. arrived in Kansas City, and he met with these three letter writers. The doctor was Miles N., druggist Bill T., and the CPA was Harvey L. They scheduled their first real AA meeting as a group for a few days later at the Victoria Hotel. They started running ads in the Kansas City Star on Sundays, and the group began to grow and grow, and they began to move and move, eventually ending up at the Pickwick Hotel. The little group was called Kansas City Number One, and it struggled. Many of the newcomers were so ravaged by their years of alcoholism that they died soon after joining, and the sobriety of other members was shaky at best. And at one point, the group was down to three members, and they didn't have enough money to buy coffee for their meetings. At another point, their treasurer got drunk and ran off with all of the group funds, $3.74. But the group survived, and it grew. In 1942, Ken S. and Charlie M. called on KB, who became the first woman alcoholic in Kansas City AA. She helped bring in more women to Kansas City Number One, so that by February of 1947, there were enough women members to organize a women's group. By 1949, there were 932 members that met on Fridays, but then controversy arose. And in 1950, several members broke off and formed the Fellowship Group, also known as the Plaza Group. There's actually a grapevine article called A Coffee Pot and a Resentment that was written about this split. But actually, the split turned out to be beneficial for AA's growth, because by 1970, there were 29 new groups in Kansas City. 15 years later, there were a total of 97, and almost that many again in other western Missouri towns, one of which was Springfield. Gene C., who had gotten sober in Kansas City Number One, had moved to Springfield, Missouri. But after 2 years of driving back and forth for meetings, she decided to start her own group in Springfield, Missouri, and this was on January 15th of 1945. Later, Jane C. also helped AA get started in Joplin, Missouri. So one night in 1940, Father Ed Dowling from St. Louis visited Bill Wilson. This was at the old 24th Street Clubhouse. And that night, Father Dowling became Bill's spiritual sponsor for the next 20 years. After Father Ed returned to St. Louis, he was contacted by someone who said that his son-in-law had a really bad drinking problem. But actually, as it turned out, it was the man who contacted Father Ed who actually had the problem. So with help from the good father, this man found four more prospects, and on October 30th of 1940, they held the first AA meeting in St. Louis. This was at the Gibson Hotel. The first newcomer got sober on December 11th of 1940, and by mid-41, the group had grown and moved several times. In April 1942, a second group formed, a breakoff of the original group. And though it wasn't actually a club, the name of it was the Wilson Club. though Bill Wilson really tried to discourage them from using that name. And part of the reason for that split was that the members didn't approve of the parent group's practice of inviting the wives to attend the meetings. See, the Wilson Club was for alcoholics only, and it had lots and lots of rules and regulations and restrictions, such as, we reserve the right to determine whether or not the applicant is a true alcoholic, and if the board decides negatively, he is not admitted for membership. And, where necessary, to advance rehabilitation money to a prospective member, that money shall be paid back, that's in all caps, regardless of whether the person advancing wants it back or not. And upon his or her first slip, he shall admit his drunkenness to the group and buy a copy of AA. Upon his second slip, he shall turn in his membership card and have a private consultation with the board. Upon his third slip, he shall be automatically expelled. So groups continued to spin off from the parent group, and by 1948, there were 16 groups in all. The first black AA group in the United States, AA-1, started in St. Louis. It held its first meeting on January 24th in 1945. They began with 5 members, and they grew steadily. AA spread to Columbia, where the first group meeting was held in October of 1942, soon followed by a second group. And the Daniel Boone Group in St. Charles was formed in 1945, while the first group in Jefferson City was also getting started at the same time. Little Rock, Arkansas had its first AA meeting on April 19th of 1940. I could spend an hour on Arkansas Connolly. Its claim to fame in AA history is that it was the first mail order group, or the first group formed solely by mail, meaning by the big book alone. The group's founders had all struggled really hard to get sober. The first meeting of these three men, who were Sterling C., Harlan N., and Bud G., as an AA group, was in late May of 1940. Proceeding almost entirely on their own with no experienced direction, the Little Rock AAs decided very early to screen their prospects, making sure that they were serious so they wouldn't be wasting their time. So the new man was asked 4 questions. 1, are you convinced that you cannot handle your alcohol problem? 2, are you willing to let a group of fellows who had the same problem prescribe a course of action? 3, will you do anything to eliminate alcohol from your life? And 4, do you believe in a power bigger than yourself? If the prospect couldn't answer yes to all 4, he was told to come back when and if he could. So then the group went even further and devised a strict plan for new prospects before they could be admitted into the group. This was known as the Little Rock Approach, and the plan worked for many, but it was also highly controversial even within their own group. Among some of the requirements, a prospect had to read the book, big book, in 3 days, keep a 28-day journal, write his case history, if employed, take a 2-week leave of absence to devote all his time to the plan. And that's just a few. So in 1942, the group moved to a larger meeting place. Macy H., the very first woman member, kept slipping and kept everyone busy. And the drunks were coming in from all over Arkansas to sober up and then carry the message back to their own communities. Macy left Little Rock, but 3 other women had joined the group. And then Floozy arrived, broke, hungry, and battered. 2 women were assigned to work with her, but she preferred male attention. So after about a week, word got around that Floozy was shacked up with 6 prospects in a hotel room, naked and drunk. But that wasn't the worst part. 3 old-timers were participating, as well as running bottles in from the liquor store. And then, when it seemed like it couldn't get any worse, one of the sober women members joined the party. This scandal shook the group to its very core and brought about a brand new rule: no women allowed. Then came along Frances P. When she was told that they did not accept women, she became even more determined to join. They gave her the big book to read, but she kept getting drunk. Finally, she announced to the group that they had a woman member, whether they liked it or not. So while Frances was still banned from the big meeting, members started holding smaller meetings at her house. And one day she finally got a list of all the members, and she called each one and pled her case. And she was finally accepted back into the group. Ruth P. was next, and then Macy H. came back, and the No Women Rule was officially revoked. In 1962, the first black AA member in Arkansas, and one of the very first in the Southwest, got sober at Little Rock. Joe McHugh was a drunken bum wandering through Tennessee and Kansas City, where he came in contact with the famous candy salesman. Remember him, Johnny P.? But that didn't help. But in the early 80s, Joe had wandered into Little Rock, where he sought treatment at the city's only rehab. He was turned away because of his color and ended up in the segregated portion of the state mental institution. Luckily for Joe, there were some white AAs who were carrying the message into this hellhole, and Joe McHugh heard it. So upon being released, he started attending white meetings. Even when faced with prejudice, he got a white sponsor, and he studied the big book and all the literature, and he became very active and very respected in Alcoholics Anonymous, and as well as in the alcoholism field. He established and directed his own treatment facility, which was totally AA-oriented, and then he began conducting step meetings on Sunday morning for the residents of his facility. Word spread, and AAs from all over town started coming and attending this meeting. Later, Joe would join up with Charlie P., the Panel 31 delegate from Arkansas, and began to hold seminars on the Big Book. These discussions were eventually recorded and are well known today as the Joe and Charlie tapes. 15 years after Little Rock group formed, Arkansas had 56 groups with about 900 members, and 30 years later, 187 groups with about 2,700 members. So, do y'all remember Dr. Miles? He was one of the three letter writers in Kansas City. So in 1942, Dr. Miles left Kansas City number one to start a hospital in his basement in Kansas City, Kansas. His plan was to treat alcoholics who needed medical care in addition to the AA message, and he named his hospital the Shrine on the Hill. At the same time, he started the first AA group in Kansas City, Kansas, which was called Kansas City, Kansas number one. However, because it met in the hospital, it became known as the Shrine on the Hill group. In 1943, another group was formed about 60 miles away in the capital city of Topeka. In October of 1944, Sid E. and Otis P. got together and formed Wichita's first permanent AA group. Kansas City, Topeka, and Wichita became the centers for Alcoholics Anonymous activity in their respective communities and in most of Kansas. So the AA in Oklahoma began with two men who were drying out in Oklahoma City at the Coyne Campbell Hospital. This was a small facility in the city side of town that specialized in the treatment of mental disorders and nervous conditions. While there, they read the article by Jack Alexander, and upon release, they sent a letter to New York asking about AA in Oklahoma. They received a reply saying that there were no meetings in Oklahoma yet, but someone would get in touch. And that someone was Johnny P., the candy salesman from Kansas City. These two men contacted others and formed the Oklahoma City group, and the first mass AA meeting in Oklahoma City was held on November 26, 1941. Reports noted that 8 were present, 1 was drunk. But by 1944, the group had grown to 60 members. In the meantime, AA had spread to Tulsa and on into western Oklahoma, and a group started up in Clinton. This was helped by AAs from Oklahoma City, one of whom was Fritz B. from the very earliest days of AA. In 1946, a group was formed in Cordell, and by 1955, there were 58 groups with 900 members in Oklahoma. As an interesting side note, you know, the birthday plan actually started in Oklahoma City. It was originally called the Oklahoma Plan, and it was the idea of Ted R., who got sober in the early 1950s. He wanted to express his gratitude by giving back to the fellowship. So every year on his birthday, he started sending in a dollar for every year of sobriety. It caught on in Oklahoma, and Ab A., who was the delegate at the time, took the idea to the conference where it was passed, and it was adopted as a suggested plan for individual members to be able to contribute to GSO on a regular basis. And so with Texas, that's my home state. Yay. Okay, but with Texas, it all began in Cleveland. in 1939 with a newspaperman named Larry J., who had drunk himself into the gutter. His editor, he worked for the Cleveland Press, sent out a search party, and they found him with no coat and freezing temperatures with one collapsed lung and the other lung with a tube sticking out of it. But after he recovered from the DTs, malnutrition, exposure, and exhaustion, the doctors told him that he would be better off where it was a little bit warmer. So he boarded a train for Houston and took along the Big Book, which he read along the way and had a spiritual experience. And he came off that train determined to help other alcoholics get sober. So when he got there, he called on the editor of the Houston Press and persuaded him to run a series of anonymous articles, which he actually wrote on Alcoholics Anonymous. And these articles actually became Alcoholics Anonymous' first pamphlets. But before that, they caught the attention of church officials who asked Larry to speak with pastors and lay people. And more important, they caught the attention of other alcoholics. One was Roy Y. from San Antonio, who had sobered up in Los Angeles. Another was Ed H., who was a great help to Larry in getting AA started, but couldn't stay sober himself. The first AA meeting was held March 15, 1940, at the YAWCA building. The group continued to meet on Tuesdays with as many as 25 attending, but most often it was a different 25 than the week before. So they spoke to doctors, too, and were finally referred to Dr. David Wade at Galveston State Hospital, who became a good friend of AA and helped AA get started in Austin. By the end of 1941, there were 85 members in the Houston group. However, dissension developed when a Baltimore transplant told the group how things were done in the East, that is, by electing a steering committee to handle the group's affairs. Up until then, founder Larry J. had been running the group with an iron fist, and when the group decided to elect a steering committee, Larry pulled out of the group and Ed H. went with them. Shortly after, Larry slipped and was hospitalized, and shortly after that, Ed H. was also back to drinking. However, by this time, AA in Houston was firmly entrenched, and in 1942, Esther E. took over as the leader of the Houston group. In early 1949, the majority of the Travis Street group broke away to form the Montrose group. The first real San Antonio group started meeting in 1945, and it eventually split into the downtown group and the Sahara Club. The first Dallas group didn't really begin until Esther E. moved there from Houston. That was in May of 1943. First meetings were held out of members' homes, but by 1945, they had an actual established meeting place. A.A. Austin stemmed from the interest of Dr. David Wade, acquired at the Galveston State Hospital before his move to Austin in 1945. And now a little bit about the early history of A.A. in Fort Worth. George McGill wrote Alcoholics Anonymous in New York in 1941, and he organized the first meeting on August 23rd with seven in attendance. But apparently that group didn't make it, because in November of 1943, Ann T. wrote New York again, saying, "Good news, Fort Worth is starting up again." In late 1945, the group decided to start a club. They rented an old two-story building at $100 a month, and one of their members won a contest for the name, which was the Harbor Club. Almost immediately, gambling competed all too successfully with the AA meetings held there. Daily poker games downstairs were for pots of $100 or so, and upstairs, pots were in the thousands. And the winners always gave the club a cut of the winnings. Jack W., a professional con man who played in the upstairs game, supplied the club with slot machines, which proved to be an even greater bonanza. They were legal in those days, and within a few months, the club had a surplus of $14,000. Ralph R. traveled to New York to seek Bill's advice. And Bill suggested that the club be incorporated separately from the group, with its membership limited to AA members. This was finally done in 1949, and by that time it had over 300 members. The Harbor Club built a larger facility with large meeting rooms and, of course, card rooms. All the while, AA membership continued to grow. Heavy gambling was banished in 1975, but the nickel and dime, poker, gin rummy, and bingo was still allowed. and more than 20 AA groups were meeting regularly on the premises. In the Southwest Texas area, the beginnings of AA occurred in Amarillo, Lubbock, Big Spring, Abilene, and Midland in the late 1940s. The first East Texas AA meeting in Nacogdoches was held in May of 1943, and 2 months later, groups were operating in Longview and Palestine. By 1955, Texas boasted 216 groups in all, with 735 members. I want to note here, too, that that Ebby came to Texas for a period of time. In 1937, Ebby had accumulated 2 years and 7 months of sobriety, but tensions were building in his life, and finally, on a trip to New York, he slipped and went out and drank again. And his life became a succession of binges, followed by short periods of sobriety. And it kind of became a game among AA members to try to be the person who helped Ebby finally recover. In 1953, a New York member collaborated with AA members in Dallas to take Ebby to the Lone Star State. This was for treatment in a clinic run by Circe W. After initial troubles, Ebby did find sobriety in Texas and stayed there for 8 years. He also found employment for several years. Ebby's Texas interlude was the best period of his adult life. He was lionized by grateful Texas people who went out of their way to meet him or to hear him speak. Unfortunately, one of Ebby's obsessions was the idea that finding the right woman would be his salvation. He did find a woman in Texas, Chloe Kay, and she seemed to be the love of his life. But she had a really bad pill habit, and when she suddenly died, Ebby began taking mood-changing pills himself and eventually started drinking again. He left Texas and returned to the New York area in late 1961. So in the spring of 1941, a Denver alcoholic named Bernard F. went to Houston, Texas, to observe how they did AA there. He came back armed with a big book and some pamphlets. Then Bernard got an article published in the local paper along with his P.O. box, and on August 19, 1941, the first AA meeting in Denver was held in the home of Sarah McPhee. 11 people attended, and a month later, with 16 members, they moved the meeting to a hotel. And in February 1944, the group began meeting in its first permanent home. In 1946, a second group formed in Pueblo, Colorado, which was made up of state hospital alcoholic patients, and a South Denver group formed about the same time. There was slow growth during the 50s. Then a big growth spurt occurred in the 60s and 70s, particularly when the International Convention was held in Denver in 1975. Colorado grew from 54 groups in 1955 to 522, with nearly 10,500 members by 1985. Robert D. of Clovis, New Mexico, traveled to Los Angeles in 1942 to find sobriety in AA, and then he returned home. In 1945, he met Pete A., whose daughter Betty was married to Bob Smith, who was Dr. Bob's son. Betty had recently sent her father a copy of the Big Book, which he showed to Robert D., and together they vowed that as long as they lived, there would be weekly AA meetings in Clovis. Albuquerque formed its first group around the same time. As for Santa Fe, remember Dr. Miles, again, one of the three letter writers? Well, Dr. Miles took regular vacations at a resort in Santa Fe. In fact, he had a nephew who lived there. And during one of these trips, his nephew told Dr. Miles about a local man with a serious drinking problem. His name was Art S. So Dr. Miles, being the prodigious AA worker, as Bill Wilson called him, paid Art S. a visit. He 12-stepped him, detoxed him, and finally became a sponsor. And in the spring of 1946, Art S. teamed with three other alcoholics and formed the Santa Fe Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, now known as the Downtown Group. In 1947, with the support of the warden, the Santa Fe group started taking meetings into the state penitentiary, and soon the inmates formed their own group called the Sundog Group, which was considered to be the first of its kind in the country. And I want to say that having done this research, I, these drunks and these traveling bums and wanderers and actually our pioneers and our AA giants, it really touched me, and I know that we all owe a great debt of gratitude to them here in the Southwest region. Thank you.